The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There are definitely still weak spots in your case that you want more corroboration on. And those weak spots are the direct involvement of the president. The questions that come up are, how much did the president know about it? How much was it the president directing it? And what was the president's motivation? And those are key questions when it comes to an impeachment offense. How you get that, I don't know. And it's a really difficult question. I think they've done the best they can so far, given the administration's refusal to allow a number of witnesses, refusal to provide an array of documents. They had Gordon Sondland testify for whatever reasons he may have had, and they were able to pin him down fairly effectively. But, you know, in a perfect world, you would get something like you saw eventually come out in the Watergate context. You would get tapes. You would get something directly incriminating that's objective.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 23rd, 2019. It's the week it all went public. What had been dry pages of deposition transcript turned into live witnesses, sometimes many of them a day, in front of the House impeachment investigation. It was a lot of material, and we have quite the gang to break it all down for you. In the Jungle Studio, we have Scott Anderson, Susan Hennessy, Margaret Taylor, and joining us about halfway through will be Alina Polyakova, and we were going to talk about it all. We're going to talk about what's happened this week, the new information we got, and what it means that we have it all live in person. We're going to talk about the foreign policy implications. We're going to talk about disinformation, and we're going to talk about what comes next as impeachment rolls on. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 476, The Week That Was on Impeachment. Okay, Susan, let's start here with just kind of where are we? We've had a week of this stuff. As far as I can tell, the polls haven't moved even a tenth of a millimeter. How much does it matter? What's happened? What's changed? And what hasn't changed?
So the short answer is we don't know. We think that we are probably at the end of the hearings or the public hearings in the House, but actually even that is not entirely clear. It's possible that the House Intelligence Committee will decide to call additional witnesses. I think we should be thinking about to what extent that did the hearings move the ball or advance our understanding over and above the sort of the deposition transcripts that have been released over the past several weeks. There haven't been big new factual revelations, although there have been some additional sort of significant pieces of information, but not really new sort of bombshells that fundamentally alter our understanding. That said, the picture has been presented, I think, with a lot of clarity. It's a damning picture. It's a picture that should be politically devastating to the president. And I think really the indisputable picture that the facts and these various witnesses have laid out, both in these closed depositions and also in the hearings, is that the president of the United States sought to condition a number of official acts, namely the release of military aid and a White House meeting, on the Ukrainian government being willing to open a series of politically motivated investigations. That this was a policy, if we can call it that, that was driven by the president of the United States personally, and the president of the United States was deeply personally involved, this was not individuals who were freelancing, that just about every individual involved fully understood what was happening, that to the extent that there were unspoken sort of inferences to be made about what the president wanted, everybody around him, both his political allies and career officials and even potentially sort of political opponents, all came to the same conclusion here, which reduces the amount that we could say their reasonable minds can differ on what the president actually meant. And as you said, it doesn't appear that this has dramatically altered public opinion or polls. I do think it's quite significant that Congressman Will Hurd has essentially said he doesn't believe that there is enough evidence for impeachment. Hurd gave an interview last night in which he essentially laid out the argument that he personally believes that impeachment requires essentially a statutory violation, criminal misconduct, and he didn't believe that the statutory crimes of bribery or extortion had been demonstrated. We can debate whether or not that's right or wrong. I happen to believe that's wrong as a matter of interpretation. But it is significant because, you know, Hurd was seen as one of the sort of open-minded Republicans who might be willing to vote for articles of impeachment if evidence was significantly strong. And so I think a lot of people are sort of taking this as a sign that when articles of impeachment finally do come to the floor, and we can talk in a little bit about when and in what manner that might occur, we are likely to see a party line vote. And that will be, I think, a significant strategic and political advantage for the Republicans because it will help them continue to paint this in a purely partisan manner. But the facts are what they are, and they are really bad.
All right. So let's talk, Margaret, about how the facts are different this week than they were last week. Obviously, the optics are different because last week we had all these people saying things on paper and we had thousands of pages of transcript. And this week we have, you know, very vivid presentations of a lot of the same information that is, you know, in the mouths of real people, some of whom are very sympathetic. On the other hand, we've also enlarged the record in, as Susan says, not earth-shattering respects, but in significant respects. And so how is the record different after this week of open hearings than it was before?
So there's a few ways, to my mind, a few ways it's strikingly different and a few ways that are sort of more details. So I'll just start.
Let's go with striking.
The striking parts for me this week were the testimonies of Kurt Volker and Gordon Sondland, in particular Gordon Sondland, because his testimony as compared to his first deposition transcript, and even as compared to the addendum or modification that he made to his testimony, you know, he brought emails, he brought all this sort of documentary evidence, and he just really laid it out so vividly. He was much more forward-leaning in his live testimony than he had been in his deposition transcript, in particular saying very specifically the president was driving all of this, driving these, you know, people getting the Ukrainians to do these investigations into Democrats. You know, he was behind the whole thing and everybody knew what was going on. That was not really like a feature of his deposition transcript. So to me, that was the, I'd say, biggest and most striking sort of change from this week. Regarding Kurt Volker, you know, having him up there sort of saying, like, yes, if the president was trying to get a foreign government to announce investigations and dig up dirt on a political opponent, that would be wrong. Having him say that live was also, for me, you know, a significant moment because that was a – Kurt Volker was a witness who I think the Republicans had hoped would sort of give them a few reeds to hang on to, and he didn't really. The smaller things were, as we've talked about before, Bill Taylor's testimony about his staffer, David Holmes, who had this story about being in a cafe and overhearing Gordon Sondland talking with the president, sort of directly linking the president – to this request for investigations.
Why do you think that's a small thing? That seems to me a rather big thing because it's one of two or three incidents we know of in which the president is very personally involved. And it seems to me for him to be You know, quite apart from the fact that it's a kind of dramatic moment, it seems to me pretty significant that there is an incident in which somebody puts in Donald Trump's voice, are they going to do the investigations?
So I'm not going to disagree with you. I think it is a big deal. I just, for me, it didn't sort of change the overall contour of the whole story. But you're right. It was something that the Republicans had sort of complained about, that there wasn't, you know, this direct evidence coming directly from Donald Trump. And David Holmes was someone who tied those words to Donald Trump's mouth. And just the last thing I'll mention was that maybe this wasn't such a big deal, but Laura Cooper, I think it was, testified that her understanding from some of her staffers was that the Ukrainians actually knew as of July 25th that there was something going on with the aid. And that was much earlier than, you know, some anyone else had testified to. So I don't know if there'll be any follow-up on that, but I did think it was an interesting note, because one of the things that Republicans have been saying is, like, the Ukrainians never even knew that there was that the aid was being held up, when in fact it seems like, gee, they might have known pretty early on.
I mean, one point on sort of whether or not the Holmes thing is a bombshell is it shouldn't be a bombshell, because we saw the call transcript. So the question, there was sort of this open question about the president's involvement. That's why, to my mind, it wasn't this revolutionary thing, although it did feel dramatic.
Scott, so you've followed this record pretty carefully. How do you regard the sort of incremental advance of the story? Not, again, leaving aside the optics, we'll talk about that later, but factually, how is the story different today than a week ago?
I think Margaret hit exactly the right points. It is the Sondland testimony. It is the Holmes statement. And there are a couple other little details that are fleshed in. But the one thing I think we really have to bear in mind is that the Sondland testimony that was elicited this week was not an accident. It is the product of a strategy that we saw the majority execute over the course of these hearings. In a lot of ways, it was the goal of these hearings, was getting that testimony. You saw them set up a clear testimony early on that pinned Sondland as somebody central to the irregular channel that Ambassador Taylor saw driving this sort of policy. You saw lots of people coming in saying they'd had all these negative interactions with Sondland. Then they stack the testimony so that you have Fiona Hill, who had some of the most heated exchanges with Sondland, somebody who was well positioned to impeach his credibility and to bring questions about his role in this, scheduled to testify the day after Sondland did, to whom they then added David Holmes, who, after the revelation that he had in fact overheard this additional July 26th conversation that Sondland had not previously disclosed even existed. It was a carefully structured set of hearings specifically to try and pin Sondland in and pin him down and say, look, you're going to be in a position where either it looks like you are the person who might be driving this, or you can say, here's the reason why what I did is right, and it's because I'm following the direction of the president. And that's what Sondland did. He caved on that last point. His testimony, you read his opening statement, it was designed to basically beat back this idea that somehow he was a rogue agent, that he was acting a rogue way. His main point throughout was that everybody knew what I was doing. And to prove it, I'm going to produce State Department emails and text messages that just 2 weeks ago I said I wasn't able to produce, to show that Mike Pompeo knew about this, the whole NSC knew about this, and that we all thought we were acting on behalf of the president. Ultimately, this whole week came down to the fact that Sondland was not willing to be the fall guy. And he decided to come out with the testimony that is most important in a lot of ways through all this, which is the testimony that directly ties all this back to the directions of the president. Now, he has credibility issues. That's unavoidable because of the shifts in his testimony. Holmes helps back him up because of that July 26th call, but he may not be able to entirely escape that, and it'd be great to have additional witnesses. But getting that firsthand witness from somebody who is by no means a never-Trumper, somebody who contributed to the president's inauguration committee, and having him draw those dots is a key advancement to this case and is the biggest thing to come out of this week, and is in many ways, again, the product of the whole process we saw play out this week.
All right, let's talk optics. So the other major thing that happened this week was we did it all in public, and all these people were not merely dry figures on paper, but were seen to tell their stories. And, you know, the Democrats had been ruminating for months about how to make the Mueller report come alive. I think we did a better job of it than they did with the Report podcast. But they did not have that problem with L'Affaire Ukrainienne, which they really brought to life this week. And so, Susan, my question is, does it matter? Who did they convince of what? And you mentioned that they apparently, correctly, I think, that they didn't convince Will Hurd, who's the probably as close to the marginal Republican voter as we're going to get. So we're still in a party line environment, not a lot of movement in the public polling. So is bringing the stuff to life overrated?
I don't think it is. I don't know that House Democrats were successful in presenting a very clear and easy to comprehend story. I think there's still a little bit of work left to be done. And I said that in part because as somebody who watched all the hearings, read many of the deposition transcripts, although sitting next to Margaret, I have to admit that I did not read every single page of them as she has. I still find myself sort of 24 hours later needing to spend some time with the transcripts, really trying to sort of distill down what are the various threads, how does sort of the Yovanovitch story play into the rest of it, all right, what did Bill Taylor and George Kent say, how does, right, there's it's almost like you're watching a movie in which there are different vignettes that are playing out, and then at the end it's supposed to all come together, right, and you realize that they're actually all part of the same story at the same time. And so I think Democrats, they did a really good job developing the evidence sort of with prosecutorial precision, really getting the evidence on the record, and in a way that it didn't appear that the Republicans even disputed kind of the factual development all that much, something that might end up being quite significant sort of for the Senate trial portion of this. But I do think that there's now some work to be done potentially over the recess period of kind of distilling that down, drawing the threads and saying, okay, this is the overall scheme that was being driven by the president. Here's how the various actors are carrying out or responding to what's going on, in a way that just feels like there's some clarity to it. And while I thought it was really powerful testimony, I still think it is a rather complicated story. And I say that because I myself am continuing to sort of struggle to wrap my mind around sort of every element of it.
Yeah. So, all right. This, Margaret, brings me to the question that I've been stewing about. All right, so you have all this testimony, you have 3,900 pages of deposition transcript and, you know, probably 15, 25 hours of live video testimony by these witnesses. And you also have lots and lots of Republicans, including like all of them in the House of Representatives, who are saying this doesn't rise to the level of impeachment. You're obviously not going to persuade them that it does. But it does seem to me that one thing you are missing is the Starr report, this document that lays out all the sworn testimony in a form that becomes very difficult to argue with, at least on a factual basis. And, you know, the criticisms of the Starr report were, you know, that it was sex obsessed, that it was about relatively unimportant questions, that it didn't rise to the level of impeachable offenses. But one thing that Bill Clinton did not try to do was argue with the facts reported in it. And so it seems to me the question of how you distill this information, Adam Schiff has closed every day by trying to distill it into a speech. You're not going to impeach the president with speeches. So this thing now migrates over to the House Judiciary Committee to draft articles. If you are Adam Schiff, what do you put in Jerry Nadler's hand? Is it just like you give him all the data and you say, okay, here's all our depositions. I know Margaret's read them. I'm not sure that anyone else has read them all. And here's all the testimony. Or do you try to basically write the Schiff report that is kind of the Mueller report, Starr report of this episode drawn from this material?
So I think you definitely write the Schiff report because it's going to be a public document. It actually could be out as early as December 2nd, some press reports are indicating. So it could be quite soon, actually. But you definitely write something that has a front to it that is readable, that is understandable for, you know, the average American who can understand in black and white what has happened here. And then you just attach to it all that other stuff that, of course, the Judiciary Committee will need. One of the ways I've seen this sort of characterized or starting to be characterized up on the Hill by Democrats is, you know, the Intelligence Committee is handling the facts and the Judiciary Committee is handling the law. So what Adam Schiff really needs to do is hand the Judiciary Committee a really tight and clear set of facts. He also, I think, can actually provide recommendations about what articles of impeachment he would recommend. So I think he definitely does a Schiff report. I think it has to be something that the public can consume. If I were advising him, I would say do not make it 448 pages like the Mueller report was. Make it, you know, 15 pages max. That should be your memo on top and then have everything else sort of as attachments. Make it something that people can understand.
You think you do 15 pages total? I would think you do like a 15-page executive summary and then a sort of 100 pages of, you know, and here's the homework. And then you throw in the briefcases full of stuff.
Yes. But,
this is
yes,
the most lawfare conversation of all time. What is the appropriate number of pages for the memo?
Scott, what is the appropriate number of pages for the memo?
Well, 17.
Resolve this dispute.
As we all know from school, it all depends on the margins and the font size. So we'll get there. We'll see what they go with. They go with a nice Comic Sans. I think it'll maybe a little shorter in page number.
Zaps dingbats.
Zaps dingbats, exactly. I mean, the way I think about this is that you do have to put this in the context of a trial because that's the closest parallel to what we have here. And we're at the stage now where perhaps the prosecution has rested, right? They've stopped presenting their witnesses. It doesn't look like we're going to get much of a defense at this point. But that's one thing Step is missing, and that is the closing argument. And the closing argument is this report that Margaret's talking about. It's the Intelligence Committee coming together and saying, here's what we've concluded. And what's kind of interesting, at least if you look at the way a lot of trials go, is they're not tight summary sort of statements. They are things that really try and pull together the actual evidence being provided, the testimony, the quotes, and pull it in, but knitting it in a kind of cohesive narrative that you just can't get when you're eliciting testimony from witnesses because you got to do only the parts that each witness knows when they're on the stand, right? So I think you end up with a balance statement. You've got to make something readable. You got to make something digestible, but it can't be summary, actually. It actually needs to be something that really knits together these sorts of evidentiary records because that's where the credibility comes from. That's what they've established publicly here. The one thing I will say I think has really come out of these public hearings is that most of the witnesses came off very credible with the exception of Sondland. Vindman took some criticism from the right particularly, but most people have come away pretty credible from this. And now they need to capitalize on that credibility by tying that narrative back to the exact testimony and words that they used to make a case. And I think that's the lens that Schiff and Goldman seem to be approaching this as former prosecutors themselves. That's kind of the path I expect them to trace.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was one. I agree that Sondland was the least credible of the witnesses, although overall he was sort of more credible than one might have expected. I thought Kurt Volker was also had some credibility issues, and they actually shared the same core credibility issue, and that is the assertion that they did not make the connection between Burisma and Biden. And that's really, really key to their personal defense, right? Why did you engage in this if you knew that what the president was doing was wrong and deeply harmful to U.S. interests? And the way they attempted to sort of thread that needle was to essentially suggest they knew the president wanted this investigation into Burisma, but they didn't make the connection that Burisma was the same as the Bidens. And, you know, Goldman and Schiff spent a lot of time with the witnesses, you know, including Tim Morrison, who said he figured it out by doing a Google search, Fiona Hill saying she did not find Sondland credible on that. She did not believe that he hadn't made that connection. It is something that sort of defies, you know, like it's impossible to believe anybody involved in this situation didn't understand what was happening, particularly because Rudy Giuliani was out in public on television talking about this precise connection. But that is one area in which, you know, I think it is going to be really important to kind of buttonhole that and really make clear that, like, this Burisma and Biden and the political advantage of a public investigation into that was the same thing. It was the driving motivation for the president. And so that is one area in which, to the extent that there were sort of credibility issues and credibility issues Republicans might attempt to exploit sort of moving forward, I think that's sort of the one that I would put my finger on.
All right. We are joined now by our Brookings foreign policy colleague, Alina Polyakova. Alina, it's been a big day for your set of issues between Ukraine, big few days between our colleague Fiona Hill announcing that a lot of the messaging around from the White House and Republicans have sort of partaken of Russian disinformation operations to today's New York Times story about Ukraine being the subject of a kind of long-term Russian disinformation op. So I'm interested as a preliminary matter just in your thoughts on the import of Fiona's testimony yesterday in relation to Russia, Ukraine, and disinformation, which kind of like has your name written all over it.
Right. So I thought Fiona's testimony just stood out so much from everything else we heard over the course of a week, because she obviously made it her goal to explicitly and very directly address these narratives we've been hearing about Ukrainian interference in the 2016 elections, which has been part of Russian disinformation for a very long time. Like, if you have read Russian media, they've been pushing this for years, basically since 2016, and all these conspiracy theories around the server being in Ukraine and Ukraine somehow working for the Democrats, et cetera, in 2016, that's been out there for a long time. What Fiona's testimony did was just put that front and center as the real problem here, that we've seen mostly these Republican policymakers on the Hill and the president of the United States really believe and pick up this Russian disinformation campaign, which is, I think, absolutely staggering. From the Russian perspective, huge success, right, to have that kind of impact through a disinformation campaign. It's incredible.
And so when you look at, we were talking before you came in about the sort of gestalt of the week of kind of going public with this. And from a sort of foreign policy perspective, as opposed to from a kind of domestic law or impeachment perspective, what were your kind of big takeaways from, you know, going from a whole lot of dry stuff in transcripts to having this kind of vividly portrayed in many, many hours of hearings?
I thought one important thing that came out from the whole week, just panning out a little bit from Fiona Hill's testimony specifically, you know, has been this kind of retelling of the story of Ukraine in a more positive way, because I think there has been this narrative, which again has also been a Russian narrative repeated by the president, repeated by many allies of the president, that Ukraine is the most corrupt country in the world, which of course is not true, that Ukraine has always been, you know, an unreliable partner, untrustworthy partner because of oligarchs, because it's a big mess over there, or whatever the colorful language the president likes to use. And so what was interesting is that you had official after official talk about Ukraine as a country of sophisticated policymakers and thinkers, people who are very much aware, which came out multiple testimonies, of the kind of pressure they were under, what they were being asked to do. They read that code, you know, that Burisma means Biden and 2016 means Clinton immediately, right? So they're relatively, you know, savvy, sophisticated, and they were being put in this really uncomfortable box. So I was happy to see this narrative being reversed through these hearings, because my concern has always been throughout this process that at the end of the day, this is going to lead us into a really, really bad place when it comes to U.S. commitment to Ukraine, and as a result, U.S. commitment to deterring Russia in Ukraine. And I hope that this is the beginning of changing that perspective and changing that narrative going forward. What I would like to see Congress do after all these impeachment hearings are done, so hopefully in the near future, is some sort of renewed commitment bipartisan commitment, which we've had in Congress all these years, to Ukraine from the U.S. Congress.
And do you like one of the things, you know, when we're sitting around before you came in, we were talking about how there is, seems to be no chance of getting even a single Republican to take the evidence seriously at the impeachment level. And so the idea of kind of bipartisan anything was not in the air when before you came in. How realistic do you think it is in this environment for there to be a bipartisan commitment, a renewal of bipartisan commitment to Ukraine? Or is Ukraine now Democratic foreign policy and Ukraine is corrupt and interfered with the election, now Republican foreign policy?
Right, that's become this kind of political hot potato. You know, I would have said that was very pessimistic about that. But actually, and I may be plugging an event here that I'm participating in.
Good.
But on December 4th, Brookings plus seven other think tanks from the full spectrum of the political line are coming together to host this bipartisan event where you have Senators Johnson and Murphy speaking, in addition to a bipartisan group of House members as well. And it's all about why Ukraine should be in the U.S. national security interest. And so I actually think that maybe there's hope.
Yeah, I actually think there might be reason for real optimism on this, in part because it's clear that a lot of Republicans are deeply uncomfortable with what the president has done. We've seen this in the past, that the ability to sort of express their discomfort in ways that are not directly confrontational of the president, things like in the past passing sort of strong Russia sanctions, have been one way the Republicans have sort of been able to allow themselves to sleep at night. And so I do think it'll be interesting if one thing that doesn't happen here is Republicans do hold the party line on sort of formal impeachment, but then use support for Ukraine and strong bipartisan congressional support for Ukraine as sort of a cowardly rebuke of the president. And maybe the moment really is ripe for that.
Well, there's a precedent for that, which is the Russia sanctions bill, which Margaret wrote, which passed with overwhelming bipartisan support, even as Republicans were kind of refusing to take the Russia questions as an investigative matter as seriously as one would like.
I should just say there were other authors on that bill as well, not just me.
So. Yeah, I didn't say you were the sole author.
Claim all the credit, Margaret.
I just want to one thought about this, and I hate to be the slightly more pessimistic one, but I'm going to strike a slightly more pessimistic note, is that when you are deterring Russia, and particularly when you're doing so with the force of threat of military force, U.S. military force really being the ultimate deterrent behind it, it's a different frame than a case where you're trying to crack down on bad actors like you were with the Russia sanctions bill or try and tweak relations. A lot of that comes out with the credibility with which the United States is willing to threaten and project the use of force, threat the use of force and project that forward. The degree to which Russia believes the United States, if push comes to shove, will back up Ukraine. I think that has been very badly damaged. And I don't think that's something that's easy to repair for Congress, because those are decisions that are left in the hands of the president. I think you can see a lot of good progress on a lot of these issues, hopefully on sanctions, hopefully on support and security assistance, things that will make a lot big difference on the ground. But I do think there's a part of the overall deterrence scheme that's going to be really hard to rehabilitate so long as Donald Trump is in office.
All right. So let's tack back to impeachment. Margaret, I'm trying to imagine the next phase. And all right, so there is the Schiff report, whether it's 15 pages, 100 pages, or 448. Is that right, Susan? And then the big handoff to Jerry Nadler comes into effect. And so first of all, what should Jerry Nadler do once he receives the Schiff report? And secondly, what is he going to do when he receives the Schiff report?
So if you cast your mind back a few weeks ago when the House passed Resolution 660 and an accompanying document that laid out additional procedures, you know, it did lay out it pretty specifically what the Judiciary Committee is supposed to do, right? It's supposed to receive the report. And at that point, you know, go on to its own potentially hearings, its own review of the information. It's allowed to, you know, collect other documents if those are available. In addition, you know, there are these other committees in the House that have been continuing their investigative work, and they were explicitly mentioned in that Resolution 660. So one question for Jerry Nadler is, you know, do you roll up and gather information from those other committees as well? It's just a big question mark. And I actually don't think anyone knows the answer to that right now, not even people who are on the Judiciary Committee itself. There are also, you'll recall, outlined in that resolution, the president's procedural rights. And they're pretty robust, right? You know, it provides an opportunity for the president or his counsel to participate in the proceedings, including by presenting their case and responding to evidence, submitting written requests for additional testimony or other evidence, attending hearings, including those held in executive session, raising an objection to testimony given, cross-examining witnesses. So that's a lot of stuff, and I don't quite know or understand exactly what that is going to look like. So, for example, are they going to put, you know, Adam Schiff and Dan Goldman, the counsel up there, are they going to be the ones to sort of present the factual case to the Judiciary Committee along with Republicans as well, Steve Castor and Devin Nunes? Is that what it looks like? Or does Jerry Nadler sort of recall witnesses that testified before the Intelligence Committee? Like, nobody really knows like what the scope of this thing is going to be in the Judiciary Committee. If I were advising him, you know, I would probably say find a way to keep this process moving pretty efficiently, pretty quickly, and pretty clearly, because I do think that Americans are going to tire of hearing not only all about this, but about hearing it over and over and over again. So if there's a way to do it in an efficient way that gets it wrapped up and with a bow on it in a reasonable amount of time, if there's a way to do that, that's what I would do.
So you don't think that that the House should follow my idea of putting the imp back in impeachment and pass one article of impeachment at a time and make the Senate try it? And then if they acquit him, just pass another the next day and make them do it again?
I probably wouldn't go that route.
Rats.
I think that probably plays into a lot of narratives that are out there about how, you know, Democrats just want to keep this going, you know, during this election year, the whole year.
It's the Energizer Bunny of impeachment.
There is one task. I actually think the Republican and the Democrats, and I agree, we don't know what it's going to look like, but they actually really do need to accomplish, and the House Judiciary Committee is a reasonable place to do that. And that's to frame up the questions for which, if the president declines to provide witnesses or testimony in response, the House is permitted to reach a negative inference against him. So one of the things that we see emerging from people like Will Hurd, sort of the centrist Republicans, is that the Democrats didn't prove their case, right? They didn't sort of take it over the finish line and proving the elements of bribery or proving that the president was involved. I think what the Democrats have to do is really distill down what are those questions in which the Republicans are saying you can't show 100% that this happened, that this is what the president meant. You can't show, for example, that military aid was explicitly linked to these investigations. Well, we know that Mick Mulvaney is somebody who is in a position to do that. And so really taking that opportunity to frame up that question to say this is our belief about what happened. If the president wants to exercise these procedural rights to dispute this under oath in a forum that can be actually challenged, we're going to go ahead and say that this is a reasonable negative inference for us to draw. We're going to move to a conclusion on impeachment articles on that basis. And I think there are, you know, five or six sort of categories of that. But it's going to be really important, especially if obstruction of Congress ends up being part of the articles of impeachment, because part of the argument has to be that you obstructed us in our impeachment investigation, and therefore we could not reach, you know, the very clear answers on a number of questions, and our Republican colleagues are using that to sort of hide behind and give us a rationale for not actually voting either to impeach or ultimately convict.
So, Alina, we're all kind of obsessed with the kind of mechanics of impeachment and kind of the way we don't really think about the way impeachment, the way the countries that are the subject of the impeachment inquiry react to it. But presumably people in Russia and Ukraine, particularly Ukraine, must be at least a little bit interested in the way our politics has come to be about interactions with their politics. How is this playing in Ukraine?
I mean, the whole time what's been interesting to me is how little it's playing in Ukraine. I think initially over the spring, when Giuliani first started to become very public, giving these interviews, spouting these Russian disinformation theories in his Fox News and other interviews around May, people were just really confused. They're like, what is going on? We don't understand. What does Giuliani have to do with it? All these accusations being thrown at specific people in Ukraine. But after, I think, the whistleblower, the meeting between Zelensky and Trump, everything that's happened since then, I mean, Ukrainians have other concerns. I mean, they have the war, you know, to concern themselves with. And in fact, that is the top issue right now in Ukraine. There are negotiations that are supposed to restart after 3 years in this so-called Normandy format in December. And that may pave the way for some sort of settlement, positive or negative. I think the biggest problem that I see and what I'm most concerned about as a result of what's happening in the United States is much more nuanced, is that the U.S. now is completely absent from the table in any of those conversations on what's going to happen in the Donbas, where Russia is still waging a hot war against Ukraine, or what's going to happen with Crimea even. Now that we don't have a special envoy anymore, we don't have a channel that Ambassador Volker was supposed to maintain with his Russian counterpart that before him Assistant Secretary of State Torian Nuland had. Now we're just not there. And I think that gives the Russians the upper hand, most obviously. And in Russia, of course, they've been loving all of this. They've been loving the fact that Ukraine is getting blamed for 2016.
And when you say they've been loving this, what's the evidence of their love? What's the? I mean, is it just a supposition on your part, or are they overt about it? How does the love manifest itself?
It's the if you watch Russian language media, so you know obviously what's being projected into Russia. There's a huge number of these political talk shows, and Russian political talk shows, I guess not that dissimilar from American ones, basically involve a round of men, usually all screaming at each other. And what they've been screaming about most recently, of course, has been, you know, how the U.S. is in chaos, that there's a witch hunt and a hoax. I mean, they're using the same language that the president has used to describe what's been happening, that Ukraine is a failed state, that is the most corrupt country in the world. And now we see the result of that. So there is, we've seen this for a couple of years, this kind of confluence of narratives between the right in the United States and the Russian propaganda machine. So when they're loving it, I mean, the basic measure of that is just to read Russian state media and to, as much as you can stomach it, watch the men yelling at each other on the political talk shows. And that's what I mean by that. I mean, it's pushing this narrative that Russia has been pushing for a very long time about Ukraine, that democracy will fail there, that it's a failed state, that it's a joke, that it's deeply corrupt. That's it.
Scott, when you look forward, how much more of a record do you want to see? If you were Adam Schiff and you were going to draft the Schiff report now, would you feel like you've got everything you need, or would you feel like there are holes that you would still want to plug?
There are definitely still holes you would want to plug, or perhaps a better way to put it is, you know, weak spots in your case that you want more corroboration on. And those weak spots are the direct involvement of the president. There are no contested facts about what the conditions being put forward to the Ukrainians really were. The questions that come up are, how much did the president know about it? How much was it the president directing it? And what was the president's motivation? And those are key questions when it comes to an impeachment offense. How you get that, I don't know. And it's a really difficult question. I think they've done the best they can so far, given the administration's refusal to allow a number of witnesses, refusal to provide an array of documents. They had Gordon Sondland testify for whatever reasons he may have had, and they were able to pin him down fairly effectively. But, you know, in a perfect world, you would get something like you saw eventually come out in the Watergate context. You would get tapes. You would get something directly incriminating that's objective, that shocks the conscience, quite frankly, and that might drive and suddenly change the narrative here. I don't know how you get that. I don't think you can manufacture that. Maybe there will be a breakthrough. Maybe that's a reason to keep these procedures ongoing so that you can keep litigating over efforts to get documents and things along those lines. I don't know. But, you know, that's the spot where you want to fill. I just don't know how they go about doing it.
Can I ask a question from a legal idiot's perspective? So all of the blocking of specific witnesses that the White House is engaged in, is there any chance of them being forced to testify through some sort of court or judicial process?
Yes, I think there are a number of things that might happen. So one is there are currently court cases that are making their way through the system right now. So one involving Don McGahn, sort of related to his testimony with the Mueller investigation. The other involving John Bolton and Charles Kupperman and some other sitting administration officials. I think whenever we should get an opinion on those cases, I think at least with McGahn early next week, and we'll see about the others. I think there's an open question if the courts weigh in and say that those people actually do have to testify, whether or not they decide to appeal it and really try and drag it out, or whether or not what they really want is just some sort of rationale, some piece of paper to point to, and that actually that kind of gives up the political protection. The other thing we might see is once there's an actual trial in the Senate and we have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court ruling on things like motions, that could be something in which people feel compelled to comply with a ruling from John Roberts in a way that they aren't as inclined to with just a subpoena from the House. So not a hugely satisfying or clear answer, but an interesting open question for now.
Yeah, I agree with Susan. And I just want to go back to one thing Scott said and make a comment. You know, think about how this has unrolled. The White House released the transcript of the July 25th conversation between Trump and Zelensky. They released it early. Just do a thought experiment, whereas if we had just gone through this, you know, 2 weeks of these impeachment hearings and say, like, now the bombshell was the release of this transcript, like, it would come out as a bombshell. Trump is talking about the Bidens on that call. And so I guess I disagree that, you know, somehow we need a bombshell here, because I feel like the bombshell came early. It's just we're all used to it now, which is like an interesting sort of psychological effect, in my opinion, about how the president and the White House has sort of managed this process.
I could not agree more. And I had that exact same thought last night and frankly kind of struck me as a pretty horrifying thought. If the transcript hadn't been released and we had had these whole proceedings and it were released today, it would be the Nixon tapes. It would be the thing that drives home this narrative that we've been driving, provides that sort of evidence. It's still there. The facts haven't changed, but there is a desensitization to it. People didn't know when it came out what the full narrative was, and it gave people a chance to kind of spin it in a different way. And in a way, you know, maybe that's an argument that the president's political instincts on getting it out there quickly may have had something to it.
That said, I think there is a chicken and egg question here, because clearly one of the reasons why so many sitting officials felt compelled to come forward, felt compelled to actually defy the White House in offering testimony, is because that transcript came out and it was so clear what had occurred that made sort of the Stonewall strategy kind of fundamentally untenable. And so I think ultimately becomes sort of a fundamentally unknowable question of, you know, if we'd gotten one versus the other. That said, you know, the White House's, I think, strategic error in releasing that transcript was the impetus, remember, for Nancy Pelosi talking, you know, right, I'm a little bit mixing up my timelines, but, you know, the Nancy Pelosi announcing support for impeachment and sort of this cascade of people coming forward and offering their little pieces of the story that allowed the House to construct this narrative. I think the question now and the challenge for the Democrats is how do you return back to that transcript whenever you don't have sort of the news headlines of a brand new revelation? How do you draw everybody back to here's where it began and here's where it ended? This is the president of the United States bringing up a political opponent on this phone call. That is unacceptable. That is impeachable.
All right. So we need to wrap up, but I want to get from each of you a sense of what is coming next. So let's just go from what are you looking for? What are you expecting? What are you thinking about as we go into this recess week, having had all this stuff happen? Scott, let's just go down the line. Scott, what are you thinking about?
So the first thing I'm looking for should come out tonight, which is that it's the deadline for a lawsuit filed by a private group called American Oversight.
So by the time you listen to that, it'll be
Sorry, out, Friday
and
night.
And it'll be yesterday night.
Yesterday night, which is a lawsuit for documents related to the Ukraine scandal from the State Department that under the Freedom of Information Act. State Department's deadline to produce the first tranche of those documents is Friday at some point, presumably going to come out Friday evening. They haven't come out yet as of today, the afternoon when we're recording. You know, I don't expect there to be a bombshell in there. I expect there's going to be things that are very bad for Mike Pompeo, perhaps for other State Department officials. But there's a potential there. And there's going to be potential as those future tranches come out and they have fights over potentially redactions and other issues. That is the part of this case, the factual part that's still developing, which is that there are many groups out there using their statutory rights to different types of documents, information, and pursuing them adamantly and quite effectively in many cases, including Lawfare on occasion, getting involved in this sort of activity. And so that's what I'm looking for immediately. As for this next week, we have to wait and see where Schiff and Goldman come out on the next steps and see. They are obviously going to produce some sort of closing statement and report, but I wouldn't be surprised if they leave open a little bit of a window for some future development, especially if something does come out in those documents this evening that may point towards new witnesses or other new directions.
So Margaret.
I'm going to go in sort of the opposite direction as Scott, maybe just for fun. I'm looking for who is going to be the person who is telling this story, the story of what Donald Trump has done here on this specific incident and putting it in the context of, you know, the Mueller report. Who is going to tell that story in a way that is convincing to everyday Americans? It's not utterly clear to me who that is. I think Adam Schiff has been doing a good job in his openers and closings of sort of bringing it all together. You know, maybe Jerry Nadler will be doing some of that. I'm really looking for who is the storyteller, because that is the way you really put it together for people and make them understand why this is important. I think it's really important to have someone who can do that well, tell that story well, because otherwise it's just not going to matter. And we're going to have this like new norm in American politics where it's like perfectly fine for politicians to go and get foreign governments to dig up dirt on their domestic political opponents.
Susan, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, I agree with Margaret and would sort of take it a step further. I'm not just looking for the person who's going to tell the story about what happened here, although that really is critically important, but about what are the consequences if you fail to hold a president accountable for something like this? What is the statement the Republicans are sending? And really sending, I think, the clear message and a message that Democrats should really be willing to own, which is they are not doing this because of public opinion polling. They are doing this in spite of public opinion polling. They are doing this because it is a solemn constitutional obligation, because they believe it is their duty and their responsibility and the obligations of their oath, and really communicating to the American public the fragility of our system and the necessity of using tools to reinforce those norms, and getting the public to think a little bit about what are the consequences if we allow something like this to be okay. What does that mean? I think that has the benefit of both clarifying the stakes for the American public and also clarifying, you know, the choice and frankly, the moral cowardice of their counterparts in the Republican Party, that are willing not just to tolerate this, but actually to run interference on behalf of a president who has really so astonishingly abused his office.
Alina?
Well, obviously, what I'm most concerned about is seeing the fallout in the coming weeks on Ukraine policy and whether we are going to get this return of bipartisan consensus on it, despite the politics or not, and what that will mean for, I think, the future of the U.S. engagement with Ukraine and U.S. policy on Russia, because these are all connected. So I think wait and see, but I am more hopeful today than I was a few weeks ago, thanks to, in a large part, to our colleague, Dr. Fiona Hill.
I just want to wrap up with a true moment of zen. If you're on Twitter, you've probably seen it. But if not, GQ today ran what I think is the greatest correction of all time. It reads, note, this story has been updated. Alexander Vindman received a Purple Heart after being wounded by an IED or improvised explosive device, not an IUD or intrauterine device. We regret the error. Thank you, Scott, Margaret, Susan, and Alina for joining us. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to all of our folks who spent so many hours in front of a television screen watching people ask the same questions over and over and over again. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, tweet it, share it on Facebook, and of course, put us on Pinterest and Instagram. And write us a review and a rating on whatever podcast distribution service you use. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this episode was Jacob Schultz. And of course, our music, as ever, is produced and performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.